Quality proteins aren't just for special occasions. With Omaha Steaks, you get unbeatable flavor and value delivered right to your door. They have an unmatched selection of perfectly portioned proteins, including USDA certified tender steaks, burgers, chicken, pork, seafood, and more. All flash frozen at their moment of peak quality. Then quickly delivered to your door in a dependable cooler. So a great dinner is just minutes away. From Taco Tuesday to a weekend feast. Omaha Steaks practically invented meat delivery, and they've been perfecting the art of premium proteins for over 100 years. With their 100% satisfaction guarantee, you can order with complete confidence. Taste the Omaha Steaks difference, a better, more convenient way to buy proteins. Start getting flavorful proteins delivered today. Visit omahasteaks.com and get $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code AUDIO. Terms apply. See site for details.
Oh, well, hey, and thank you for downloading another podcast from Simon Mayer's Books of the Year.
Correct. And we now have merch. Can we talk about the merch?
Yes, let's talk about the merchandise.
Yes, we've been set because obviously we, in previous podcasts, we've had sort of our logo superimposed onto our chests. Yep. But now we actually have merch going. It looks fabulous, by the way.
Yes, it's got the logo, which you'll see on the podcast, but it's now on a T-shirt and a sweatshirt. And this is from Paul Cartwright, marketing manager at Premier Sports.
Yes.
And it's a slightly uncomfortable for me burgundy colour, which is a little bit Aston Villa, a little bit West Ham.
Okay, so you'd want yours in white?
No.
No?
No. A white T-shirt would be... Yes, true.
Yes, you would.
But also kind of a darker, more royal blue.
Okay, yes.
I would suggest. But anyway, it's a very nice gift. Thank you, Paul. And, you know, we need... I feel as though we should get some of these for listeners.
Do you mean as in a prize?
Yes.
Do you think? Or do you mean get listeners to buy them? Both.
Actually, both. That sounds good. So we're going to try and work on that because I know that what everybody... If only we'd done this in time for Christmas.
Yes.
But then we didn't know that we had friends at Premier Sports. We thought we were still just being friends with Michelle Obama, The Economist,
Yoko
Spectator,
Ono.
And Yoko Ono and Harry's Razors. And we love them all.
We do, particularly Harry's Razors.
Premier Sports haven't even paid anything.
No, they haven't paid.
But they've just sent us some very nice merchandise. So thank you very much indeed to Paul Cartwright and his chums. And if we can think of a way of promoting, you know, doing a competition.
Yes. I'm sure we can come up with a question or something.
Lots of response to Ian Rankin being on the show. Jackie Martin. Superb interview with Ian Rankin.
Oh, yeah.
On the new Rebus novel. Deeply insightful, fascinating and entertaining. Could listen to Ian talk all day. Brilliant interviewee, gorgeous voice. Never mind us. Never mind all the work we put in.
Well, Ian Rankin did reply to that by saying, two gifted and genuine interviewers made my job very easy. Well done, Ian. Know which side your bread's buttered on.
Do you want to mention the other Ian?
Who's Ian Carter, who is our favourite golf correspondent. And he said, what can I say? Fave interviewers talk to my fave author. A belting listen. Now Christmas can't come quickly enough because the new Rebus is top of my wish list. Probably should get that Mad Blood thingy as well, which obviously... Obviously, is reference to a fabulous book written by someone else.
Mad Blood Thingy.
Mad Blood Thingy. That was very much how I remembered it. Yeah.
All right. Ian, thank you very much. You're almost our favourite golfing correspondent. I don't know any others.
No.
But you're still our favourite. This from Nadja, who's in Vienna. Simon and Matt, finally it happened, the Ian Rankin interview. I was beginning to think you were bluffing. I really enjoyed listening to your chat with Mr. Rankin, and I loved hearing him reading aloud from his book with that great Scottish accent. That is how I will imagine and replay the dialogue in my head from now on. Speaking about dialogue in books, in your previous podcast, Lee Child talks about how this is something that can make or break a book. I agree, and I think this is one of the many factors that make the Rebus series so enjoyable, that Rankin creates a lively and authentic dialogue between the characters. Mm. Unfortunately, I haven't got around to reading Lee Child yet. Actually, I've hardly read anything other than Rebus since I caught the bug this summer. Maybe there is a support group that Matt and I could join.
Quite right, too, yes.
Whether it's in Vienna or not, Nadja, I don't know. But it's an interesting point about dialogue, because if if you don't believe what these characters are saying, then you're
no, that's right. And it was that was a real insight because I've started thinking that as well now. Is that if you can't get the way people talk to each other right, then it's not working. Andy Carrington emailed. I recently had the great pleasure of briefly meeting Ian Rankin at a book event in Bristol, where I asked him about a photo he'd posted on Twitter that shows three quotes written on post-it notes that he keeps pinned on the wall in front of him when he's writing. It was hard to make out the writing in the photo, and he kindly tweeted the quotes to me the next day. And they are, the wisdom of the novel comes from having a question for everything. That's from Milan Kundera. Every book is the wreck of a perfect idea. What a great quote that is. That's Iris Murdoch. And doubt is your friend when you're writing a novel. Anthony Giardina. It's a fascinating insight into the mindset of the writer. Doubt seems like it is a constant for the author, as is the need to continually adapt ideas and compromise with oneself. I find it reassuring in a way that even the great Ian Rankin has doubts when writing. I wonder if you could ask what other thoughts, inspirations, mantras, words of wisdom, reassurances your guests keep in mind whilst they're writing. As an aside, isn't it great when you meet your heroes and they turn out to be friendly, kind and thoughtful people, willing to take the time to write to and engage with readers like me? Ian Rankin was all that and more. Keep up the great work. Your podcast is fabulous. Easily in my top three favourite podcasts that I listen to. Winky face emoji, Andy Carrington.
Well, I'll accept being in the top
three. Top three will do for me, yeah.
Just before we get to our main conversation with our guests, one of our regular correspondents, who's called Rachel, just says at the end of her latest missive, "I've just left the Richard and Judy podcast a 2-star review, and I've recommended others check out Books of the Year. As theirs is deeply unsatisfying."
I mean, obviously, we don't encourage people to go and start only leaving 1-star and 2-star reviews
elsewhere.
Another podcast. We do, however, strongly encourage you to leave 5-star reviews for us. Thanks very much.
And here come 2 more 5-star guests. Okay, so here we go with Cressida Cowell talking Wizards of Once, Twice Magic and the Golden Atlas with Edward Brooke Hitching. Hello, Edward. How are you?
Hi. Thanks very much for having me on.
It's very nice to welcome you to our very small, but rather beautifully appointed studio. And Cressida Cowell, very nice to have you here. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
And we have 2 books to discuss, Wizards of Once, Twice Magic, and also The Golden Atlas. And it goes to Matt to describe both. Do them
yes.
in whichever order you fancy.
Right, well, I'm going to start with Wizards of Once. So the dominant colour here is green. This is very much going to be attracting your eyes when you're going into bookshops. And it's beautifully illustrated with our 2 main protagonists taking up the front of the, or lower portion of the book, with the Wizards of Once in sort of fiery writing. Number one best-selling author, Cressida Cowell, picked out in silver, and the title Twice Magic at the bottom.
And it's sort of unfair to compare it with the Golden Atlas, but anyway, go ahead.
Yes, goodness me. So, well, the dominant colour here is gold, as you would expect with Golden Atlas, but wow, what a... We've got a globe dominating that front page with some great illustrations around it that's obviously been taken from a previous atlas, but Edward Brooke Hitching, the Golden Atlas, as I say, in big, bold gold, the greatest explorations, quests and discoveries on maps.
Okay, which kind of describes exactly what it's doing. And can I just have a conversation about maps then, just at the very beginning? Because, Cressida, your book starts with a map. Mm-hmm. And we see the world at which we're going to be spending the next few hundred pages. And obviously, Golden Atlas has got loads of maps. But from an author's point of view, Cressida, what's the relevance of the map? How important is the map for you?
The map is a really important starting point for me because a map makes an imaginary place feel like a real place. As soon as you've drawn the map, you know how long it takes to get from Incanzo's fort to, you know, somewhere else on the map. Mm. And so it feels very real to the child reader as soon as you're doing, because human beings are so clever about time and space and where they are. And if the fantasy is consistent with the map, it makes it feel very real. I read something very interesting about... you know that film, The Shining, Stanley Kubrick, who's a bit of a genius, he drew a map of that spooky old hotel, and somehow that makes the place work as a real space. So as soon as the little kid goes through the space on his little cart, it makes the film even more scary. Because, so I think a map is incredibly important in as a story starter and also to make the lie feel real, as it were. I always start with a map, and I loved books with maps at the front.
Yeah. I imagine you must have done, Edward, given that you've spent so much time looking at maps. Do you like a story that starts with a map?
I come almost entirely from it from a sort of historical point of view. My dad was a rare book dealer, and he worked from home. His shop was at home, so I just grew up with books and maps on the wall. The book I wrote before this was about lies that were made real by putting them on maps, called the Phantom Atlas, and it's that exact same idea. The point of the Golden Atlas was trying to say that look at maps in a different way, a historical map. Don't see them as these sort of flat, quiet things hanging on the wall, but think of every little detail on them as what it was to the person who discovered it. And suddenly you realize that the map is just this tapestry of hundreds, thousands of different adventures and just capturing these stages of progress, of exploration. So,
there's a book that's just out also, which I've written, contributed a chapter called The Writer's Map, which is about exactly what you're talking about, maps and their relationship to how writers, and there's a chapter by me, and there's a chapter by Philip Pullman, and then there's talking about Peter Pan, there's all the maps in Tolkien. It's a similar, it's fascinating how maps are so inspiring to writers, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The other thing that you have in common, and I'm latching on here to a very small thing, one of the maps I like the most in your book is one of the earliest maps of Australia, maybe the earliest map of Australia, which I think is labelled New Guinea. Anyway, and it's got dragons in it. So because of
here
course,
be as, dragons.
As we all know, Australia is full of dragons and lions and minotaurs.
Although Here Be Dragons has never been put on a map.
There's
only one existing example of it on a very old globe. But that map, the first sort of printed mention of, the outlining of Australia was entirely by accident. When the Dutch were searching for the coast of New Guinea, they found part of Australia, but they didn't realise they had. And so it was all kept very secret for a long time in their proprietary atlas called the Sea Torch, which no one else was allowed to find because obviously it was their trade routes secretly.
So Cressida, Wizards of Once, Twice Magic, so tell us where we are and get us up to speed so that we know exactly where we are. We haven't got the map for the podcast, so just fill us in all the details for this world.
Well, this is a world split in two. So the wizards and the warriors are fighting each other. The world is covered in wildwoods. It's end of the Bronze Age, beginning of the Iron Age. And so the British Isles are covered in wildwoods. And Azar and Wish have been brought up from different tribes that have been taught to hate each other like poison. So it's a sort of preteen Romeo and Juliet set up. And Zar is a wizard boy who has no magic and he will do anything to get it. And Wish is a warrior girl who has a secret, who has a secret magical power. And so it's about what happens when these two children meet and can they see things from each other's point of view.
And the one thing we should say right at the very beginning is, and anyone's familiar with your work, is that you write and you illustrate. And I don't know anyone else who combines these things better than you do,
because
we deal with lots of books that are illustrated. Where there's a writer and there's another. These are very different skills usually, but with your books, they're a design feast. Everything is the text and the pictures are kind of one. So my last question for Matt is just on the process, when you're writing about Wish and Zar, do you write the words? Do you come up with the pictures first? Do you do them all at the same time?
I draw the map first, and then I do draw the characters. And some of if I have a new setting, I would draw a setting to get a feeling for the setting and a feeling for the world. It is a really complicated process, particularly the end bit, because you're absolutely right. It has to work together like a 350-page witch book, really. So we have to fit the text. Luckily, I'm the writer, so I can be absolutely vicious with the text. So I'm sitting there with a designer, and it doesn't fit the design. I say, OK, lop that bit. and if I wasn't the writer, you'd have to ring up the writer. But we're sitting there together, and we can do it absolutely on the spot. It's so integral to getting children reading, because my books are actually quite challenging. I mean, they're the language isn't dumbed down at all, but and the ideas are quite complicated. You know, I talk about heroism, politics, what makes a great leader. You know, all of these ideas are washing around in a very plot-driven kind of. But what makes it accessible for children is the speediness of the narrative, but also the visualness of it. So I get loads of dyslexic readers, despite the language, because they have a payoff. You know, a book is so difficult to decode for a child, whereas film and telly are just magically beamed in. But if you have the payoff of the illustrations, you know, helping you through the text, as it were, it enables children to read way beyond, you know, their expected reading level.
I'll tell you what I took from your book, and it may well be that it's just me, because of my own sort of touchstones. But I got a real gothic sensibility coming through. Mm-hmm. And and that's from the illustrations, but also from the writing. And it really, really charmed me because I was a bit of a goth when I was growing up. And there was a Pixar movie out a few years back called Inside Out, which the basic message of that was it's okay to be sad. It's okay to be down.
Yeah.
And the attraction of goths when I was growing up was it's okay to be a bit weird. It's okay to be different. And that was something I took from your book, was that that you had characters who were a little bit weird, who were different,
yeah,
and that other members of society were perhaps finding perplexing, if not threatening.
Mm.
But the message I was getting from your book was that that's okay.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether that was that just me taking that, or was that a deliberate thing from you?
Very deliberate, and it really resonates for children. I mean, that's a thing that I carry on from How to Train Your Dragon, and I get so many messages from children who are being bullied or who are finding it hard to fit in, to say how much that. I mean, that's the number one concern of children, is being bullied. So I get a lot of messages from children saying that you know, that's something that they're worried about, and certainly that's something I worried about as a child. I mean, I was different. I was a bit different. I was a bit. And I think that's a very common worry of children.
Is the goth thing there at all, or is that just my imagination?
I can't imagine Christian as a goth.
No, I can't see you at the Sisters of Mercy gig somehow, no.
I was never a goth. I'm so sorry. I was not a goth, but maybe I was a goth.
Although some of the characters, that you've written about, like Snotface,
Snotlout,
and Gobber the Belch, and Dog's Breath, the Durbrain.
Oh yeah,
were they
seen them live? Yeah, very good.
Yeah. It's that's so interesting. You should say that. I've never had that.
I think I should take you to a Sisters of Mercy gig, and you'd fit in straight away. Great.
Yeah, no, but definitely the thing of the person who's a bit different having something interesting to offer is something that runs through. But yes, it's a real juggling act to get everything in there. So to be moving. To tell the plot, to be funny, but also to be wise all at the same time. And I'm trying to kind of make it a bit like a piece of music, and the pacing of it is complicated. It's difficult getting it.
Can I ask you to tell us a little bit about, just one other, I mean, there's loads of different characters that I could ask you about, mm-hmm. but could you tell us a little bit about Zsasz Giant?
Crusher.
Yeah.
The giant at Crusher is definitely my father. I often don't mean to write people in. You know, you don't set out, okay, I'm going to write about my father, but that often ends up happening. And I drew the picture of the giant, and oh my God, it's my father. The giant is my father.
I should say the giant is not a kind of classic giant. He's a thinking giant.
He's a walking giant. He's a walking giant. He walks through the forests, and he's a philosopher giant, and he walks through the wild woods, thinking great thoughts. It's a complication because, you know, my father wasn't a philosopher. My brother is, by coincidence, I'm sure. My brother is a philosophy professor, but the giant is the picture of the giant. You draw it, and you think, "Oh my God, it is my father." And running through the books is very much, there's no, the hidden life of trees is something that I was very interested in. That was a book that we were talking about earlier, is because my father was a great environmentalist. He was chairman of Kew Gardens, and then he was chairman of the RSPB. And so every walk with him, you know, he knew what that bird was. He knew what those trees are. And so I read a lot of books, like Robert McFarlane's books, about wilderness and nature. And I want to teach children about nature, get them concerned about nature, because, you know, we are in trouble as a world. We are in trouble. Children are losing connection with nature. They're losing connection with how reliant we are on nature. So that's an important, just because you're writing little fantasy books about wizards or dragons doesn't mean you can't be addressing some of the great issues of the day. And that is one of the biggest challenges facing us all, is wilderness and our relationship to it and nature, and how we're just taking it all for granted. So the giant is my father, and those are his concerns, and he knew what that tree was. He knew what it meant, you know.
There is another character.
Every walk with him was an adventure.
Definitely. There's another character I want to ask you about. And again, this was a thought that struck me as I was reading it, is how essential it is to have a good baddie. You need a really good baddie. And I want to talk to you about the witch smeller. Which is, by the way, a great witch smeller straight away. Like,
another rock band there.
Yeah. It's so obvious you've got gothic sensibilities and have no idea, Cressida. But anyway, the witch smeller, which straight away, when I was reading, the thing that I thought of straight away was obviously the child catcher. Straight away, you think, oh, here we go.
Oh.
That, I don't know whether that was in your mind at all, but certainly...
Well, I don't consciously think these things.
No,
awful?
But yeah.
People say, yeah.
So when you come up with the witch smeller, was that enormous fun? I often find with authors that when you're writing the baddie...
I love writing the baddie. Like Alvin the Treacherous, who is the baddie in the How to Train Your Dragon. Oh, they're so enjoyable to write. It's quite interesting, this book, because you have... Because also the mother, Sycorax, is... Sycorax is the witch in the Tempest. She's the witch in the Tempest, so it's another name for it. So I'm playing a lot of games. You know, the mother and the father, are they good or are they bad? Is the mother good or do you think that Sycorax is good or bad as a matter of interest?
Well, I thought she was good.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I just put these things in. Whereas the witch smeller is very enjoyable because you can just write him. There's no...
Because straight away, as soon as he arrives...
The name is a bit of a giveaway. so I love playing games with that. Yeah, and he's just purely enjoyable to write. The King Witch is he looks positively sweet, though, compared to the King Witch, who really is... I mean, he's really bad. Didn't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Witch Smeller is a sweetheart
compared to the King Witch.
The books we're looking at on Books of the Year this week, Wizards of Once, Twice Magic, Cressida Cowell, and The Golden Atlas by Edward Brooke Hitching. And we'll do more in just a second. Cressida Cowell is here. Edward Brooke Hitching is here. The Golden Atlas and Wizards of Once, Twice Magic are our books. Edward, when you were... What would you say is the target audience, Cressida, by the way, for you? 10, 11, 12?
It's so difficult to say because the reading level of kids varies so much in this country. Mm. So they're being read independently by kids as young as 6, but then they're also being read by year 8, year 9.
Yeah.
So how do I... So that's fascinating. I love that challenge. You have to write for sort of such a wide age group.
These are the books, Edward, that... I think, as you were referring to in an earlier conversation, that, you know, wouldn't it have been great to have had these when you were 8 and 9?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Disappear into this world.
Yeah, and what you were talking about the sort of the outsider child imagining that, that's what I always thought was clever about how your characters were designed, because if you are usually the kid who reads, I don't know if it's a stereotype, but for me, I was usually up a tree away from doing sort of whatever the popular things were. And that's what I always thought was clever about something like the character design of like Harry Potter, mm-hmm. who was normal, quite shy, kept away. But when he went into this new world, everyone said, oh, we know who that is. And he's got more abilities than even he knows. And if you're a kid reading that and reading about your extraordinary character, it's so exciting. You immediately associate yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been great.
I mean, the extraordinary characters in in your book, Edward. Some of them we know because we've read about them. Captain James Cook, for example, you know, people like Walter Raleigh, people like that. And yet you are introducing us to a whole different way of looking at maps. And you say right at the very beginning that these maps are alive with stories. That's what they are. They're just different ways of telling stories. Can you illustrate your point by mentioning a story maybe that we don't know that you came across and which has become part of your Golden Atlas?
I think one of my favourite characters from the history of exploration has a name that I'm always astounded we don't know. It's not recognised everywhere, and it's William Dampier. I don't know if you've ever come across him.
No.
So late 17th century, he was the first man to circumnavigate the globe three times, the first Englishman to step foot on Australia, the first natural historian. He's cited in the Oxford English Dictionary more than 1,000 times for introducing these words into the new language, like cashew, barbecue, chopsticks, soy sauce, from his explorations. But the fascinating thing about him, and it's why that particular chapter has the title of The Educated Pirate, is because as literate as he was, which was very unusual, he was also a pirate. He was also seizing ships and living the high life on the high seas.
I mean, there's a villain like that in Flashman, isn't there, who's a pirate who quotes Latin all the time.
So that's probably a direct influence.
Yes, it's probably from him.
Exactly. Well, and so Dampier's books are some of the most valuable in rare book collecting in terms of exploration and travel. And yet he's sort of not very well known. So in the book, I've tried to provide maps and illustrations that, in just as Cressida, you were saying about how, you know, a map can really sort of immediately make the world real in the mind. It's the same with nonfiction as well. The moment you see those particular lines on the map, and you can tell exactly what part of history you are because of, if it's around this time, you know, Australia, the East Coast was, until Captain Cook reached it, on maps it was just a blank. It disappeared. It became part of the unknown world. So we only had half of Australia on these maps.
And I love the transition through your book as we go, because to start with, it's sort of like they're very romantic pictures. You know, it's okay, illustrators, let's do some dragons and let's do some lions and whatever it is, merpeople and all that kind of stuff, because we don't really know what's going on over there. And then gradually, as you go through the centuries, science and maths takes over, and it's almost like a different art form. You know, one stage it's fiction, and then it becomes non-fiction.
Absolutely, that's great that you could get that from that book so easily, because that's what I was always worried about. Is there's so much history to cover that sort of basic progression might get lost. But it is fascinating looking at how maps develop as we develop, and how medieval mappamundis, like the one in the Hereford Cathedral, were more for pilgrims who couldn't read. And they were curiosity cabinets displaying God's wonders. You know, they were visual artifacts with no particular focus on geography or practical use. And then, of course, we started using them to find our way around. We'd rediscovered Ptolemy's science, and so coordinates started being attributed to maps, and suddenly spatial reasoning became a thing. And so belief features like the Garden of Eden, which is so prominent on medieval maps, the Mappamundi are oriented to the east with the Garden of Eden at the top as our guiding light. Mm-hmm. Suddenly there's no room for features like that, so they get pushed to the side. And then there's that wonderful thing of how we start to sort of rationalize but still allow the existence. So of course the Garden of Eden wouldn't technically be on a map because it was destroyed in the Great Flood. So of course we can't find it.
Logical.
And then they just gradually disappear, and the world, as you go through the book, the lines increase, and we start to see how the world comes into shape.
What is astonishing there is how quickly the maps that you see through the book start to resemble the maps that we know now. It's sort of, by the time we get to the sort of 16th century almost, those maps would be recognisable to you and I if we were looking at globes now. The thing I want to talk to you about most, and what struck me as I was reading it, was the motivations of explorers. Now, the obvious motivations are those like, bluntly, money, financial, and faith as well, the people wanting to spread their faith around the world. But I want to talk to you about the lesser known ones, and particularly what were the motivations of the very, very early explorers who weren't searching for El Dorado, weren't searching for, or weren't wanting to spread their faith around the world, because I think that's really interesting.
Well, the first part of the book is ancient explorers, because again, I felt like you don't read enough about explorer, like the first ever named explorer in history, was an Egyptian called Harkouf. And so we talk about his motivations. The reason we know about Harkouf is because he engraved his autobiography on his tomb, which has survived. And so he proudly lays out letters that he received from his boy pharaoh, Pepi II, who was 8 years old, dispatching him to this land of Yam, that we're not sure where it is, but maybe sort of southern Sudan. And so Harkouf relays his missions, which were almost entirely to bring glory on himself and his family and his pharaoh. And there's one amazing letter that he wrote to excite his pharaoh, to announce his return from the land of Yam, where he tells him that he's bringing home the gift of a dancing dwarf of the god from the land of the spirits. And so he gets a letter back from Pepi, who's incredibly, this little boy, incredibly excited. And he says, "Come northward to the court immediately. Thou shalt bring this dwarf with thee. Take care lest he fall into the water." And so it's really interesting to go back, study these motivations. And like you say, they do vary, because there's a Persian explorer called Sataspes, who was given the choice of being executed or a worse punishment, which was to try and sail around Africa. So he chose that, and he failed because he met with currents that obviously they didn't understand, and his ship was stalled. So he returned home, hoping that, he thought, it's quite impressive enough that I've traced the east coast of Africa, but he was impaled anyway.
Impaled anyway. Yeah. It's also the myths as well, though. I had no idea that Walter Raleigh, one of the reasons he set out was because of El Dorado. He was wanting to find El Dorado.
Yeah, I think in school, when we are taught it, we're told it's his participation in the main plot, you know, against James I, and off with his head in Old Palace Yard. But the reason why the myth was so serious, and obviously the reasons why he was so desperate to find it, are obviously Lost Gold City, based entirely on a rumor of El Dorado, literally translates as the Gilded One. And it was just a story that would, by that time, had become extinct.
But it was a story that came from somewhere.
It did.
In
it
the
came
sense
from the,
that there was great
Yeah, it came from the
there.
Muisca tribe, and it was about their chief who would dust himself in gold and wash himself off in the lake. So they thought, if this tribe has so much gold that they can just wash it off every day. So they searched for lake. They thought it was Lake Parame, but that was also mythical, although it's mapped. But he then was sort of returned to England, was in jail for a little bit, but the crown needed money. So they thought, what better way than to find a golden city? So he was released, blinking into the daylight, and sent back to find it on the one condition: to not endanger the peace treaty with the Spanish. But unfortunately, his party sailed up the Orinoco and, in their zeal, attacked a Spanish outpost. And because of that, Spanish demanded his head as punishment.
I just want to mention one aspect which is in this book, which you mentioned people, names that we won't know.
Yeah.
So I'd like to add to that Lady Mary Wortley Montague.
Oh, yeah.
And Maria Sibylla Merion, because you've got a section on the most sort of influential women in this world.
Yeah.
And if you'd asked me before I started the book, can you name a single woman explorer or when we got involved, I wouldn't have been able to mention anybody. So there's a start of a correction going on here.
I mean, hopefully, and obviously it's not enough, but it's up to a certain point, it's just impossible to find a sort of significant female explorers, because they simply weren't allowed to go anywhere. You weren't allowed
on
ships.
The Vikings, Viking women went all over the place. You just don't have the records. The sort of recent archaeological
but also
explorations to show that, you know, Viking women were exploring out there with their husbands, and were that was a start society anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I had to sort of think of it from a sort of cartographical point of view as well, like you say, records, but also exploring geographically. And you know, this European ban or prohibition on just female presence on a ship.
Yeah.
But another name that you might not have heard of is the first woman to circumnavigate the globe.
Who's that?
So she was a lady called Jeanne Barret, but she did it incredibly bravely, dressed as a man. So it was in 1767, which you can imagine being the only woman, even in disguise, on a ship of men.
And nobody guessed.
Well,
just like Bob in Blackadder.
Yeah, exactly. So she sneaks aboard as with her partner, who was a botanist, to go on the first French scientific circumnavigation. But her identity was discovered. They were left at Mauritius. And then eventually her partner Commerson died, and she eventually made it back to Paris. But in arriving back in Paris, she completed the first circumnavigation by a woman.
I do want to ask you just briefly about Francis Drake. And you've sort of already touched on the sort of piracy that was going on, this sort of licensed piracy that certainly British explorers were doing. It struck me as I was reading, though, that that Drake, when he was sort of plundering these Spanish galleons and going to ports and stealing everything, the most important thing that he was picking up was maps. It wasn't always gold. It was maps. That's where the real value lies.
Absolutely, and that's actually a common thread in particular accounts of ship seizing, and it's definitely true of Francis Drake, because when he popped out into the Pacific, having navigated the Strait of Magellan, the Spanish didn't even rarely carried guns on their ships, because they just weren't used to anyone else. They couldn't imagine anyone else being there, and so you can imagine from an English point of view, there's this whole new world of data to collect. But one of my favourite stories is from Sir Walter Raleigh doing the same thing, when he captures a Spanish captain, Pedro Sarmiento, and interrogates him over his maps, his new, and he points to one particular island that looks quite of tactical use near the strait, and says, "What is this? It's labelled the painter's wife's island." And apparently Sarmiento laughs and just says, that is because when it was drawn on the map, the painter's wife was beside him and said, "You know, can you put in a little island for me?" and Sarmiento says, "And I fear there are many such painter's wife's islands on these maps."
Edward Brooke Hitching's book is The Golden Atlas. Cressida Cowell's book is Wizards of Once, Twice Magic. Will there be thrice magic? I imagine...
There is, yes. Absolutely. I'm working on it right now.
Cressida and Edward, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thanks to Cressida and thanks to Edward, two most engaging guests. You just get the feeling, Cressida could obviously fill hours of your time with conversations about, I mean, just to do the illustrations that she does in the writing is extraordinary. And Edward is just obviously a mine of information.
Quite right, yes.
And you can hear Cressida and Edward very shortly when we do the Q&A. That'll be with you in a couple of days. Thanks for listening.